Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM.
Hello and welcome to Alaska Edition. I'm your host, Zachariah Hughes. Today we're discussing water, specifically the absence of adequate water and sewage systems in rural communities across western Alaska. Though there's been a lot of progress building facilities in the last 20 years, the job isn't done, leaving many with limited access to potable water. It's not merely an issue of convenience. There are elevated health risks, economic consequences, as well as questions of fairness in resource allocation. And amid diminishing state revenues, along with accelerating climate change, the problems are rapidly worsening. My first guest is Bill Griffith, part of the Village Safe Water Program with the state's Department of Environmental Conservation, who works developing sustainable sanitation systems in rural communities. Bill, welcome.
Thanks.
And my other guest is Jacqueline Estes, news director for KNBA here in Anchorage, who's just finished a five-part reporting series called Kick the Bucket, looking at rural sanitation. And to start with, Jacqueline, tell me about your series, where you went, and what you were surprised to learn about rural sanitation.
Well, I went to Kotzebue, Kivalina, Bethel, Tuntutuliak, and Queethluk. And then on a separate trip, on a different project, I had also been to Alakanak. And I interviewed people in all these different places about water and sewer. I think the biggest thing I learned, I was shocked, actually, to find out that there are people who are chipping out ice from rivers and hauling it home and melting it and using that as drinking water. And then in other parts of the year, I mean, when it's warm, of course, they're hauling water. And a five gallons of water weighs 40 pounds. So I was just surprised. I'd heard that there were problems, that there was a lack of water and sewage systems in the bush, but I didn't know it was to that extent.
Mm-hmm. And is it spread equally across all kinds of communities? I mean, in the places that you visited, can you give us a range of what it means beyond just a kind of hauling to, mm-hmm. to not have piped water or in-home plumbing?
Well, I went to Queethluk, which is getting water and sewer, and I went to Alakanak, which has had it for a long time. And in Alakanak, they've had a lot of problems with erosion, with the Yukon River flooding. And James Blow, the city manager there, he had such a sense of urgency about this and basically said, this village will be ruined. It will be devastated. People will leave. Other people, people who might come here will not come here if we don't have water and sewer. So there was that. And then Queethluk, which where people were super excited about getting water and sewer for the first time. Half the village was hooked up. The other half wasn't. The other thing that was shocking about all of this is that, for instance, in Kivalina, people use a honey bucket, a five-gallon bucket fitted with a toilet seat as their toilet, and then they have to empty it, and they have to take it by snow machine or a four-wheeler out to the dump. And, out there, animals can get into it. The bags break open. You have human waste on the ground in the open. And it turns to dust. It flies around. People might drive through it on their way, to and from the dump. And so this is getting scattered around. Kivalina is on a barrier island. So the sea ice is not there the way it used to be to protect the village from fall storms. And when it flooded, the ocean came up over the dump. And so you had all that kind of stuff getting washed over into a lagoon where people swim and fish, and there are berry bushes on the other side. So it's a whole range of things.
Mm. But, and we'll come back to the health, the health risks in a little while. But before we do, I want to ask you, Bill, about some of the where these infrastructure shortages are distributed across the state, and, mm-hmm. and really help us better understand the scale. How many households are we talking? How many individuals?
Okay. Well, at this point, we've got roughly 3,500 homes around the state that don't have running water and sewer. Those homes are concentrated in about 30 communities that don't have any centralized, say, piped water and sewer system. But there are also a number of those homes in communities that have a piped water and sewer system, but everybody's not hooked up. So population-wise, probably runs a little over 10,000 people without running water and sewer. Those communities and those homes are concentrated majority in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, but there are some in the northwest and in the interior as well.
Mm. And so what are some of the alternatives for, you know, moving water in? Because I know teacher housing tends to have it, even in mm-hmm. in communities where it's not there. Oftentimes there are washaterias, mm-hmm. The schools will have running water. So, mm-hmm. I mean, can you say a little bit about how the different infrastructures and facilities are allocated and where they're put in?
Sure. Well, years ago, we've never had enough money to build all the systems that are needed out there. So years ago, we tried to make sure that every community had a water treatment plant with a source of water and at least a washateria, which is a facility that has laundry facilities and some kind of bathing facilities, typically showers for the community to use, and also a public watering point where they can get water that's typically treated and tested and we know is safe. So that's what's generally in every community, along with the school having running water and then typically the teacher housing. That's kind of the minimum level of service in every community. So in those communities that we say are unserved, they typically have at least that level of service.
Mm-hmm. And Jacqueline, one thing that surprised me in your series was the frequency of illness that comes about as a result. And one thing I had to double check on was that you reported that in communities without access to flush toilets and piped water, children are 11 times more at risk for pneumonia. Explain why that is.
Well, when people, you know, Bill mentioned that there are washaterias, and in a lot of villages, I mean, there are operating and maintenance costs, and so what they do is they charge people by the gallon for water, and some people prefer the water that they can get out of rivers and lakes. They like the fresh, unchlorinated taste. But I can't help but think that some people are using that because they can't afford, you know, to pay for water by the gallon. And so when you have to haul it or pay for it by the gallon, people conserve it. And in a lot of, I mean, I would say most of the places I went, if there wasn't running water, people would have a basin in the sink. If they had two sinks, they'd have two basins. One was soapy water, and the other one was, not soapy water. And all day long, everybody would wash their hands in the same water. And you and I, when we wash our hands, we use a gallon. This is from the USGS. We use about a gallon of clean, warm, fresh water, typically. Well, in some of these villages, people have, they self-ration to the point that they're using about 2 gallons a day. And that's not enough, you know, to keep your hands clean. Those basins can become kind of a bacterial soup. And then if people aren't washed, and there's a lot of overcrowding, so the conditions are ripe for spreading viruses and bacteria.
Right. So I wanted to ask because a lot of the times the water discussion is about conservation, and it seems like there's a risk from over conserving or conserving mm-hmm. in ways where there's not due consideration. And can you just run through? I mean, you'd mentioned 2 gallons a day for general use. How does that compare to general use in places with piped water?
Well, the average American uses 80 to 100 gallons a day.
Per person.
80 to 100 gallons. And mm-hmm. when we're talking in a place like Tuntutuliak, where you part of your series mm-hmm. takes place, it's about 2 gallons.
Two.
Wow.
Yeah.
So Bill, I wanted to ask you, kind of taking off from that, in 1994, 30%, only 30% of communities in rural Alaska had piped water and plumbing. In 20 years, that was up to 77%. So that's a huge gap that was covered. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm curious how that success or how that progress was made, and then what barriers are left with closing that final kind of hurdle.
Yeah, well, beginning in the late 80s, early 90s, we had an influx of primarily federal funds into Alaska to make it possible to design and construct a large number of what we call centralized water and sewer systems, which for the most part means pipes. It also means a limited number, about a dozen or so, of systems we call water and sewer haul systems. But still, they're what we consider to be centralized systems where Water is collected and treated at a central water plant, typically stored in tanks, then distributed out to homes via either haul vehicles or pipes, then collected again and disposed of in a sewage lagoon. And so there were dozens of those systems constructed over the last really 20 or 30 years. And that's primarily how all those homes were hooked up.
Mm-hmm. And what's changed? I mean, if anything, that federal money, I'm guessing, has kind of ebbed a little bit. I mean, were there line items in the state budget for maintenance costs? Are there grants available? I mean, how do we keep paying for equipment upgrades?
Right. Well, a couple of things have changed. Number one, the funding has gone down significantly. We're getting less than half the amount of federal money that we were getting only 10 years ago. In addition, the state typically provides just the required match for those federal funds. So the amount of state funds is proportional to, you know, the decline in federal is proportional to what we've seen on the state side. The other thing is that it's gotten harder and harder to construct these systems in the communities that are left. They're the hardest to serve communities. There's typically harder to find good sources of water. The geography might not lend itself to having a gravity sewer. It might, in some places, there's not even gravel available for construction, which is kind of your basic building block for water and sewer. So it's gotten harder. We're dealing with more challenging communities. We have less money to construct it. Another factor that I suppose we'll be getting into is just the aspect of what it takes to operate and maintain a system. And unlike many other services in rural Alaska, there's no subsidy available to help communities run their water and sewer systems. So we're also dealing with communities that have very limited economic activity. The homes don't have a lot of income, and it becomes a real challenge to think about where the money would come from to operate and maintain a water and sewer system.
Mm. And Jacqueline, you got into that, and I believe it was the third part of your series mm-hmm. with the operator or the assistant operator in Kivalina, if that's accurate. If I have my
it facts. Was a remote maintenance worker in Kwikluk. He's based in Bob White. He's based in Bethel, and I had Charles Enoch from KYUK with me. They volunteered his services, and it was fabulous because he speaks Yupik. And so we went to, and that was especially helpful in Tuntutuliak, where it seemed like everybody spoke Yupik as their first language. And in Kwikluk, Bob White took us on a tour of the water treatment plant and the sewage lagoon, and especially at the water treatment plant, he was pointing out why it's expensive, and that's in part because everything has to be heated to keep it moving, and then also because a lot of it is computerized, and so you have all these systems. And then when you're in a village with not very much economic development, you don't, and a small population, you don't have the economies of scale to spread out the operating and maintenance costs. And so, I mean, we didn't get into the details of how things are falling apart, except in Tuntutuliak, everything having to do with water delivery had broken down and didn't work anymore.
And I wanted to ask, because you reported that on average, most of these systems are designed to last 20 years. And the average right now is 23 years. I don't know which of you wants to speak to that, but Bill.
Well, I can say that it's typical to expect a new system to last 25 or 30 years. And most of them do last that long. In fact, we've got systems out there that are 30 and 40 years old now. But what you face with a system as it ages is different parts and pieces just breaking down more frequently, more leaking pipes, parts that you can't purchase anymore. There's a lot of old filtration equipment out there that you can't even buy pipe parts for anymore. So there's a need to just come in and try to replace large sections of these aging systems. And we use the same source of money to come in and upgrade and replace system components as we do to build new systems. So every year we have to make those kind of decisions about whether we're going to use a dwindling funds to try to keep some of the aging infrastructure operational, or how much we use to continue to try to build new systems.
Not as cleanly line-itemed out as AWU here in Anchorage for capital expenses, operating expenses.
Right, right. I mean, you know, we have to make that decision every year, and you know, there's not enough for either one. Communities wait longer than they ever have to try to for help to come in and try to upgrade and replace their aging systems.
And they're pretty much charging the max from the users. So in Anchorage, we're paying 1% of our median incomes for water and sewer, and in some villages, it's 7%. And 5 to 7%, and that's a lot to pay every month for your water and sewer.
Well, and that gets into something that you had brought up, and I believe it was part 5 of your series about power cost equalization. And I will be honest, I do not fully understand what that term means. So can you start out by just explaining what that is and how it's pertinent to this conversation?
Well, years ago, I mean, you know, we've had oil money for since the 70s, and at one time, there was a huge emphasis, and I would say it's probably continued, to put in lower cost sources of energy in different places. So there have been, you know, dams and what, power plant. Well, anyway, a lot of money went into urban areas to reduce the cost of energy. Not as much went into rural areas. So rural legislators said, let's even this out a little bit so that the state subsidizes the cost of energy in rural communities, and that's called power cost equalization. And Brian Lefferts at the UConn-Kuskokwim Health Corporations noted that, as Bill mentioned earlier, the state subsidizes all kinds of utilities, but it doesn't subsidize water and sewer operation and maintenance. And so he was suggesting that the state have something equivalent to the power cost equalization program.
Anything to add, Bill, from your work on this?
No, it's something that we've talked about for years, and there have been a couple of demonstration projects on that to be able to demonstrate that if we were able to take a little bit of the money that we're spending on capital projects and use it to help support the operation and maintenance of these systems that we're constructing, we could actually save money in the long run. But that's a decision that's never been made by either the state or the federal government in Alaska.
Well, and this gets into the territory that I'd like to ask both of you, because I'm sure you encounter the criticism, you know, in your work, that people who say, you know, especially in these lean times, we do not have the money to be, you know, sending towards projects that have a radically higher cost per capita than their urban counterparts. And I'm curious to hear from both of you, you know, arguments for why this is important to pursue, even if the economics might not pencil out for some people. I don't know, do you want to start
talking? Well, the state budget last year was $13.2 billion, and the state put $7 million into water and sewer, and that was the minimum required to meet the federal match. And especially in the heyday, it seems like we could have put a lot more money into this. A study in the 1990s recommended that the state invest $120 million a year into rural sanitation, and it didn't. And so now there's this huge backlog, and it seems, you know, and we're out of money. So one argument, I mean, there's two sides to it. These villages don't have a lot of money, and there's not much of an economy. People in villages say, well, part of it's because it's hard to have economic development when you can't offer these kinds of services. But the other argument in favor of it is that is the public health issue. 1 in 4 babies in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta region are hospitalized for respiratory infections. There's also a really high incidence of skin infections. And so, I mean, if you meet somebody whose baby has, you know, as I did in Tuntutuliak, who's recovering from pneumonia, where their lips were turning blue before they got medevaced out, you kind of go, oh, you know, something's got to be done. But on the other hand, if you sit and listen to legislators debating what they should cut to, you know, meet the, to, you know, what they should cut so that we can stay within our income, then, you know, you kind of look at it. There's two sides to it. It's complicated.
And Bill, I mean, you've been working on this for years. I'm curious how you justify it.
Well, I think a lot of people just believe that running water and sewer is something that people in this country ought to have. And, you know, most of us were born with it and have never done without it. At least, you know, if anybody goes without it, it's by choice. You know, they move out into the woods. But so it is sort of a basic expectation, I think, that people in this country have running water and sewer. And we were all born with it, but people in the villages weren't, and it seems like we're just trying to catch up. A lot of the systems that people have around the country were originally constructed with state or federal funds. So it's not like we have it in Anchorage for any different reason than we're trying to provide it in rural communities. But I want to at least say that it's not as if we're not sensitive to the fact that it does cost a lot of money to be able to provide running water and sewer in rural communities, and we need to figure out a way to bring that cost down. I don't think that we can continue to expect that no matter how expensive it gets, that's something that we should automatically accept. I think we have to find ways of bringing the cost down, and that's something that we're trying to do as well.
And that is something that we're going to talk about in terms of what projects are on the horizon. But before we do, I just have one kind of more general question. It's for either one of you, if there's anybody that can speak to it. But, you know, how do you address criticisms that, you know, do we really need what's so great about plumbing, about flush toilets, about these systems? I mean, the native people up and down the coast lived for thousands and thousands of years without most of these systems. And, you know, I guess I'm just curious to hear, why is this not just a evangelizing mission on behalf of an industrial system that doesn't appear to be working or has a hard time penciling out economically in these regions? I don't know if either one of you has an opinion on that.
Well, let's see. What's your question again?
I guess my question is, you know, is adequate sewage and water systems, are they de facto good, or is this just something that we've decided to pursue? And
well, I'll say that after in Bethel, 40% of the people are paying by the gallon for their water. And I'd been to Bethel before, but I'd never brought it up, and I was amazed when I was talking with people at all the different ways that people in Bethel conserve water. And I became very conscious of my own water use when I was traveling in these areas, especially after I knew how much effort went into getting it. And I think that economic development and public health are the two drivers, I mean, the two reasons why it should be there.
I would just add, and I think you could have an anthropologist on the show to really talk about some of this, but running water and sewer is something that kind of goes hand in hand with the kind of economy and the kind of communities that people live in now. Maybe that wasn't true 100 years ago when people were moving around and kind of following, you know, sources of food and moving to where there was water and moving away from a particular living place as time went by. But when people become stationary, they live in the kind of houses they're living in, they're sending their kids to school every day and trying to make a living, the idea of doing without running water and sewer, I just don't think it's viable anymore. I think it's a kind of a fact of the way we live now.
And so what are some of the solutions that DEC is pursuing? I mean, we've heard reports out of Bethel about gray water systems that are being developed. DEC has a program on kicking the honey bucket, and tell us what's on the horizon and what you guys are looking at.
Right. So as I mentioned previously, most of the progress we've made over the last couple of decades was what we call with centralized systems. What we're trying to take a hard look at is what we're calling decentralized systems, which is more of a household-based system. So rather than having a large multi-million dollar treatment facility and then pipes in the ground, we're looking at what can be accomplished at the household level, including treatment of raw water sources, reuse of gray water, potential treatment of wastewater from that household at the household level. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at all of that and seeing whether we can significantly reduce both the capital cost and the operating cost. And we have a project at the state we call the Alaska Challenge, where we're trying to take a look at that. Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation has a program called Dump the Bucket, that they're trying to do the same thing. And the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium has some a pilot project up in Kivalina, where they're doing the same thing.
And Jacqueline, really quickly, anything else that you want to add about what's on the horizon?
Well, climate change. I mean, I talked earlier about what's happening in Kivalina, but also in Alakanuk, where the Yukon River is flooding and it's washing out their system. And I interviewed somebody at the Corps of Engineers who said that there are dozens of communities in Alaska that are facing this kind of hazard.
Thank you so much to both of you, and I wish we had more time to go into that. That is all the time we have for this episode of Alaska Edition. Thank you to both of my guests, Bill Griffith with the Village Safe Water Program and Jacqueline Estes, News Director for KNBA, and we'll link to her reporting series, Kick the Bucket, on our website. And thank you at home for joining us. I'm Zachariah Hughes.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.